All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine, which I guess I should remind you is celebrating its 15th anniversary this very year. We also, our first Fretboard Summit was 5 years ago today. I can't believe it. All that incredible footage and all those incredible memories a bunch of us had down in Northern California 5 years ago. Feels like a lifetime ago. So this is a very weird week to be doing anything on the guitar or music front because, of course, everyone is staring at their news feeds and seeing what's going on with the U.S. presidential election. But I wanted to give you guys a distraction, a very, very cool distraction. So I'll give you a little bit of the backstory of today's guest. Kevin Bright is an amazing guitarist and musician from Canada. He's been on all sorts of incredible records. He's played with Roseanne Cash. He was on that Katie Lang drag record. Countless credits. He's even on the new record by Fretboard Journal reader and amazing singer-songwriter David Gillis. Please, everybody, go check out that new David Gillis record. It is so cool. It's kind of Warren Zevon-y. I don't know how to describe it accurately, but it's a fun record. Anyways, Kevin put out a record in 2019 that I listened to endlessly at the Fretboard Journal called Stella Bella Strada. This was a record where he basically crafted an entire record around his new Joe Yenyaziello guitar that he just got. That record was amazing, and I listened to it constantly, like I said, but I never reached out to Kevin. I feel bad about that. Then he just put out a record called I Love You, a double record. It's on his Bandcamp page. I'll include a link to it. 30 tracks of him playing all the parts of a mandolin orchestra. Yes, a mandolin orchestra, like the stuff that you would see in the old Gibson catalogs. He's playing all the parts, and then he's got guest vocalists from all sorts of stripes. The song collection itself, it's all covers, is amazing. And the record is just mind-boggling. So when that came out, it's like, all right, I need to talk to Kevin Bright finally. So this is the conversation you are about to hear, me interviewing Kevin Bright and talking to him for the first time ever. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you will check out his work. Like I said, I'll include links in the show notes. You're going to want to, if you're a fan of Ry Cooter or Blake Mills, you're going to want to hear that Stella Bella Strada record too, just FYI. Before we get to that, we have a sponsor, of course, that is Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup, gig bags, studio, monitor stands, pedal boards, pedal board bags. I love everything that they do, and I am so grateful that they are supporting the podcast. So if you do order from them, let them know the Fretboard Journal podcast sent you. And if anyone out there, by any chance, works for a brand that might be a good fit for the Fretboard Journal crowd, reach out to me. We are taking new sponsors for both this podcast as well as the magazine itself. Obviously, times are kind of weird now. We want to keep thriving and keep putting out great content. So we would love it if anybody out there needed the Fretboard Journal bump. And if you are out there and just loving what we're doing and loving interviews like this, the easiest way to support the show is just to subscribe. We have, of course, our quarterly keepsake magazine, which we've been doing for 15 years. You can get the print edition, the paper version, the fancy version. Or if you go to fretboardjournal.com and click on the subscribe tab, there's also now a PDF version, which is just $30 no matter where you are in the world. And it'll get delivered to your inbox instantaneously. And then you'll get stuff the minute we're done with it, which is fun. And you don't have to worry about the postal service. So those are two great ways you can support the show and everything that we do. Obviously, there's no big corporation behind the Fretboard Journal. It's me just pushing this thing up a hill. And so we would love your support. All right, here is my conversation with the one and only and amazing Kevin Bright. I hope you enjoy it. I will just give you a quick tease. Next week's podcast guest is Nels Klein. So if you have not subscribed to this podcast on your favorite podcast feed, now might be a good time so you don't miss that episode either. Kevin, thank you for talking to us. I mean, you've been blowing me away for years. I've been feeling guilty for the last 2 years because we listen to the Stella Bellestrada record here at the office all the time, and I never reached out to you. It was a late discovery. But then the icing on the cake, you just released I Love You, and it was like, all right, I'm calling Kevin up. And so here we are. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, I guess I should say, just so we don't rehash stuff that's already been said very eloquently before, Steve Dawson did an incredible two-part podcast with you on his Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast, which I should recommend everybody, regardless of if you're on it. But let's get a little primer on Kevin Bright. Sure. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in northern Canada, northern Ontario, in a little town that no one's ever heard of it. I think the people who live there have never heard of it. It's just this on the Trans-Canada Highway, and it's about where I am now. I'm talking from Toronto, so I'm about 8 hours northwest. That's where the town is called McCarroll. Little. I don't even think it would be a hamlet. It wouldn't even be a hamlet. It's one of those places that people go by it and they wonder if anybody really lives there. That's where I'm from.
How many people actually live there?
250.
Oh, wow. That is small.
I think the birth death ratio are the same. So when somebody's born that day, somebody dies because it doesn't seem to ever leave 250. And it was that way, I think, when I left. And then I think it's still that. It's a very, very, very small place, right? And it's a Canadian Shield. It's like it's a celebration of all things Canadian Shield. You know, the geophysical, the geography, it's rugged. And there's nothing up there as far as, you know, movie theaters or venues or stores.
Well, how did your folks end up there?
My father was a prairie boy who moved to Northern Ontario, and he met my mother and they got married. Okay. And so he got a job. He's a musician, but you know, he played everybody's weddings, everybody's funerals. He did that, but he worked in the paper mill, and there's a very strong pulp and paper mill close to that little town. So that's what he did. He worked there. My mother raised us 7 kids.
Wow. So you had a music background. Your dad was playing music. Was he playing guitar?
Yeah, he did. But I think those guys, like, it's funny because nobody played one thing. Like, they all played whatever they picked up. So he played, we had a lot of instruments in the house, which he kind of blew our minds that he would be, you know, he would play. And I think I never hear him playing it. And he'd pick up a violin and he'd play along to something and he'd put it down. And I wouldn't hear that for another year. He had an upright bass in the house. He'd play that. So he played a lot of things, but his primary instrument, I would say, was guitar.
Okay. And did you end up taking one of his guitars when you started playing?
It was really hard to play, I remember. I still have it, actually, a Hofner. He had a Hofner archtop that my mother bought him. And I remember really trying hard to play it. I found it really hard to play as a kid. And there was I think it was a nylon string guitar. And I was around 6 or 7. That's when I started playing guitar. But that was easier for me to play. So I think that was it. But his guitar was impossible.
Got it.
Yeah.
Did he teach you, or did you find a different teacher or a different route?
No, he taught all the kids. All the kids from the neighboring town would come. But he never, it's like, I don't know if like barbers cut their own kids' hair. Or, you know, they just sure. You know, they just cut, you know, they cut everybody else's hair. And you, but I didn't have any lessons with him, but he had taught my, one of my brothers. And that brother would show me things. So indirectly, but I never got a lesson from the guy, which is kind of funny. I guess I that really, now I know I'm in therapy.
Tiny town. Did you want to escape at first chance you got to a bigger city?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That was for sure. The Trans-Canada, I used to go to the ball field. It was a baseball field and the bleachers. I'd go there in the middle of the night and just watch the cars go by and think, I can hardly wait to get out of this place. Because there was nothing there for somebody who was a musician. Mm-hmm. Not really. You have your friends and you play, but so you're just thinking of leaving all the time, which I think is normal for a kid anyway. I think kids who are from Brooklyn probably dream of getting out of Brooklyn. You know, it's what we do is, you know, when we get older, that's what we do. We get our responsibility. We want to have responsibility. Let's get the hell out of this place, you know? So yes, I definitely wanted to get out of Macaro. That's for sure.
What was the first stop?
Where I am now. Isn't that funny? Toronto. I went to Toronto and then traveled a lot, like in the course of 40 years, I traveled all the time. So I was on the road. But rested head in Toronto, then moved back, not back up there, but moved outside of Toronto when we had children. And then, but I was always flying out of Toronto. So it was really basically the greater Toronto area, the GTA,
sure.
where I've been. Yeah.
So being a kid from a small town, what was the Toronto music scene like? What was that first step? Was it a rock and roll band or something else?
Well, it was originally college. That's what got me out of the house. Was I went to a music college, and the college was called, it still is, it's called Humber, and it was considered the Berklee College of Canada. And there's a lot of, to get in, you had a lot of kids want to get in. So it was a lot of, you know, you had to audition to get in. So I originally went to, there, 17, 18. And then I quit, of course. I don't think I lasted the year. Well, I didn't last a year. And then, but the city itself, Toronto, the scene in Toronto was insane. There was a lot of incredible musicians. You could go down and any day of the week and hear Ed Bickert playing. And that was amazing. But there were so many great guitar players and musicians, and Toronto's really multicultural. And so as long as I've been here, and that celebration of music, it's everywhere. So it was really as a kid coming from that little town, you know, any given time on a subway platform was more people there than was in my town. And so it was always a place you can go hear music. So it was, I remember thinking it was insanity, a good insanity. It was just, this is really amazing, you know, constantly playing, and it was just incredible.
You are, we'll fast forward through some pretty, pretty big names. You've played with, obviously, Nora Jones and Roseanne Cash, and I mean, on and on. You are one of the great backing guitarists or guitarists around. When did the mandolin come into your life?
Well, it's been in me for a long time because largely due to where I'm from, because that was a bluegrass belt where, like, Northern Ontario is considered, it's a rainbow country. They call it the rainbow country. And a lot of country players there. So mandolin was big. It was, and I love the sound of mandolin. Like, I just really took to it. I don't think I ever played a bluegrass gig. Like, I was not a bluegrass guy. Like, I didn't consider myself a bluegrass mandolin player, but that was, I think, around my mid-teens when I really took to that. I really loved it.
Was there one in the house?
No.
One instrument that wasn't there?
Yeah, I'm thinking about that now. No, there wasn't one there, but they were definitely around, and I can't remember which one I had. I think I had a harmony I think it was a Harmony, and it was a great one. Like you see them now, and they're, I don't know where that one ended up. I don't know what I did with it, but it was beautiful. And that's one I had for a long time, but, there's nothing nicer than hearing. It's one of those like instruments that when you have two mandolin players playing together, there's something beautiful about that sound. That's why those orchestras were so incredible, because, you know, to have all these mandolins and mandola and mandocello together, it's a sound that is spectacular. And that Gibson made, you know, we're making mandolins and mandolas and mandocellos. They were making them for orchestras because, you know, bluegrass hadn't been invented yet. I don't think Uncle Penn and Bill Monroe, I don't think that was happening at the turn of the century. So all the instruments were made to be in love with each other, you know, so that inner, you know, manufactured EQ is insane. Like, and they get along so well, you know. So I was really, when I get together with some friends and we play mandolin, I just love that sound. It was angelic and all that beautiful stuff. It sounded like nylon string guitars at times, you know?
Yeah. Forgive me for not knowing, but when you were out on the road with all these big names touring endlessly, were you taking a mandolin too, or were you just bringing guitar?
Yeah, even when I wasn't asked to, I brought a mandolin. And the thing is, it would be depending who I was playing with. I would play, like, if I knew there was a really strong chance they're just going to hate it, I would just bring an acoustic and I would just practice. And I was always playing, practicing, whatever. But I had electric. I have electric mandolin, and it's a Joe Yanazello, uh-huh. who I know you know him.
Yeah.
And Joe built me a mandolin, I think in 96, and I would take it on the road all the time, and I'd always work it in somehow. Working into something that was going on in the music. So I always bought a mandolin on the road, and they're not that big to take. And I, like I said, it was the way I really tried to incorporate on whoever I played with to play mandolin, even when I had no right to do it. And times the music, to be honest with you, was over my head. And I just thought, why am I playing that? Like, why am I even playing? And I'm in front of people playing, and I'm gonna make an ass of myself big time on this. Like, I have no idea what is the best way right now to play E-flat 7, sharp 9, sharp 5 on this right now. Play it. So I would probably just play the root. Boo-doo. And if somebody smarter on the bandstand played that fully, fully beautiful chord, I looked pretty good. Where all I was playing was root. And I had my eyes closed, like I really knew what I was doing. But then, as it went on, I just say, well, I know how that goes. And I just play. So, and nobody, and I wasn't fired from those gigs. So it worked well. Like, it really worked great on those gigs. And I would bring mandocello on the road when I felt more confident to do that.
Now, was the electric that Joe built for you, was that his first electric mandolin? Did you commission that specifically? Were you like, was it a one-off thing?
No, that was not. I know he had built, it was early though. It definitely was early. I think I was the first mandola for sure. And I know it was the first mandocello that he built. And the first octave mandolin for sure. The Stella Bella for sure. And the Cupcake for sure. But the mandolin, he built one before. And I wanted to bring it on the road. And I was playing with Katie Lang. And that definitely had room for mandolin for sure. That show. And it was allow you to do it. But I think he had built a mandolin before. I'm almost positive he did. Okay. Yeah.
So what, and I will talk about your, people are going to want to hear about your guitar side, but this mandolin thing, this I Love You, this record's just, it's blowing my mind, and I'm trying to wrap my head around it. So you've got the entire, there's not a single guitar on this record. It's all mandolin family. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. And those instruments, how many were Joe's? How many are vintage? What do those instruments look like?
Yeah. None of them are Joe's because they were all acoustic.
Yeah.
So yeah, Joe didn't, I've not yet anyway, he hasn't built an, I don't think, an acoustic mandolin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were all, and that I Love You is my fourth mandolin orchestra record. It was, but it's the one where, well, it's a review just came in. It was a great review, and it said that it wasn't so much, my record, I Love You, isn't so much a record as is a telethon.
Well, even if you just made a mixtape of the originals, it would be one hell of a mixtape. The fact that you're making a mandolin orchestra behind it. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. So all those guys on that record, all those mandolins, around the same age. The mandocello and the mandocello and the mandola, I think a year apart, like 1908, 1909.
Okay.
And then the octave mandolin is from a guy, Peter Sachin, a guy who makes really, really beautiful, inexpensive mandolins and octave mandolins in Saskatoon or Regina, one of the two. I think it's Saskatoon. And it's great. It's a great octave mandolin. And then I have a flat iron mandolin. And then it's my national mandolin. It's all over that from the 30s. And then there's so many that came with that. And then I would play a little bit of tenor, my Regal tenor from Chicago. That one was from the 30s. Is that it? Oh, and then... Lyon and Healy, beautiful mandocello. So there's two mandocellos, but what I did is I really wanted something in that bottom end that was a different sound. So what I did is I took my Gibson, K2, and I restrung it with octave strings. I broke so many strings trying to figure out yeah. which ones could take it. But I did it. So it's complete. All four courses are an octave apart. And it's, I think I invented something there. I think I should take a patent on something. Right. I think, I don't know, just for putting strings on it. I don't know if you can get a patent for that. Maybe it's just bullshit. But I know it's that with the Lyon and Healy, which is strung normally. And they're tuned in fifths, is wicked. They just, there's no fighting going on there. Like I didn't have to do anything. Like as I engineered that record. So I rarely changed anything because they're already naturally EQ'd. So I would just go back. Maybe I go back 3 inches from the mic or I go up. But the instruments were completely naturally EQ'd. So that's what I did on that record. I Love You is all those guys.
And was this a pandemic project or was this brewing before COVID hit?
Yeah, this was before COVID, and I capped it at, I had 11 songs and I was done. And then COVID came and I thought, I'm not done. I'm going to do some more. Then I ended up being, 35 songs. I love so many tunes. And I thought, I can't believe I made a record and I didn't put any Bob Dylan on this. I couldn't believe I didn't. And I love Bob Dylan. So I, pick a Bob Dylan song. And then I just thought, well, License to Kill was the one I came up. So there's all those. Then Neil Young. I thought, I didn't have a Neil Young. And how can I not have a Tom Waits song? How can I not have a... And I just kept going. And then I got to about 35. And then I weed it down and it went to 30. So majority of it was a COVID deal. But it's been in my head for a long time. So almost in a way, I feel like I've been working on it for 5 years, even though the actual getting down to brass tacks was really over, was COVID.
Yeah. On guitar and on mandolin, obviously, you're one of the great interpreters, coverers of tunes, and you're really able to get the essence out of them. When it comes to I Love You and coming at it from a mandolin perspective, what's your process like? What comes first? Is that low end? Are you always kind of doing the bass? I mean, it's all rhythm with mandolin. So how do you do this? What comes first? Tell me your process.
Well, I pick the song and then it usually comes from the mandocello, where I just sit and then I'll pick a good key that I think. And then I'll ask, you know, like there's 30 different singers on the record. So I'm in cahoots with them to see if they like the song, if they feel comfortable with the words, and then what would be good key. And then once I get that, then it goes to the mandocello. And then I just kind of let it go. Like I go into record and I just kind of free associate. And then I just arrange it from there. So then I just start working on the arrangement, thinking, okay, wouldn't it be great if it had, you know, a harp section. And then how do you do that? Like you said, when there's not a lot of sustain in the mandolin world. So I'd say, well, if it fanned, so it'd be, you know, I'd be taking a walk with my dogs and I'd be walking and I'd think, hey, what if in that song, My Heart Cries for You, what if it fanned? How do I get it to sound the mandolin sound like a harp? If I had 8 mandolins, and it went, so 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1. Then the next mandolin goes 1, 2, 2, 2. And the other one goes 1, 3, 3. And the other one goes 1, until you build up 8 of them. And then I would pan it. So the one that starts, the very first one starts in the left speaker. And it goes, bong, dang, 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 right speaker. And it goes over. And I'd have to plan, oh, that'd be kind of cool. And so I would plan, like you see a harp player, you know, they go bling, glong, glong. And so I get ideas like that. And I would think, okay, how would I make the mandolin sound like a harp? So I'd have to let it decay. So you're counting and you're making chord changes at the same time. So that kind of stuff, that's just an example of one of the things I would do. And I also played the bass on the record, all the upright bass. So I've been studying upright bass for a while. So a lot of that was completely, I'd have a mandocello part and I go, now I'm going to try and double it with the bass, and I'd have to learn it. So that would be, there's a steep learning curve for some of the things, like that was definitely for me, you know, to get away with 8 songs. Okay. But 30 songs, it was really, yeah.
Which of these songs had the most actual tracks?
I can tell you without, because it gave me the most problems, was Pour Me a Drink, Teresa, from one of the I'll Work for Your Love, the Bruce Springsteen song. That one, I think there's 39
okay.
Parts. Yeah, parts, like, the, you know, like a little bit of double than that. It's, and I was just... And I didn't arm the tracks like usually you do. Is you in a non dysfunctional way, you actually you write the name of the track and you go, okay, Manicello. And you write it out, type it, and then you get yourself ready. It was so fast recording it because I was on a. I just I go okay. Like while I'm doing the part, I'm thinking, you know, it'd be really great if I doubled this on the mandola, and I knew right after I finished, I'm going to forget it. So I had to right away. So the job was after it was recorded, I had to then go and figure out where is the manicello? Where did I put that mandolin? And then I had to figure out. So that was a pain in the ass because it was so big. And the funny thing with mandolin is anything, the more you put on a track, the smaller it becomes. So the concept that I'll make a really big track by putting in 36 instruments, your track is really small because there's nothing, not that it's not breathing, but the air gives you a lot of wonderful space, and it gives you that sense of things being big as opposed to tight. So that was a learning. That was something. You think after making four of these records, I would have known that, but no, I didn't. So, but that was the largest one.
I'm still wrapping my head around. Was there an intention with every track to use every member of the mandolin family or not?
Yeah. Well, it was, but there was some that seemed to be like Eleanor Rigby. Is such a sad, lonely, lonely song that it. And when I started thinking about the words, I just thought, if it just had the mandocello by itself, which is a kind of a lonely instrument, I thought that with the voice would be enough. That would be, I don't have to do any more. So some things just seem to be a mandolin quartet to me. That just seemed right, but. The majority of it was I really wanted to go for the orchestra. So I really wanted it to be arranged and again, I use the word big, not for lack of a better word, just a big ensemble, you know?
Yeah. Are there any tracks that or any songs that just didn't, you wanted to get them on, but it just didn't work on the mandolin?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a Highway to Hell. That didn't work. And it wasn't because I don't know, this is going to sound horrible, but it's just not that good of a song. I know it sounds horrible, but lyrically, I love the song so much, but it just, it didn't speak like the way it didn't hold up as this is a really great song. It's a great riff. Do 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 do. It's a great, like I could play that for 10 hours. I just love that. I can play on a kazoo. It's fantastic. So it's great. And then the words come. And then I just thought, it just didn't work. And then it became almost a joke. It almost became like, you know, I don't know how many people can discern between mandolin and ukulele. You know, many times I'd be playing mandolin. People will ask me how long I've been playing ukulele, you know? And I usually say, oh, not that long, you know, but so it sounds like a little bit like, it was play along with AC/DC, you know, it didn't have the weight. And I really arranged it. Like I made it, it was like a Brazilian, I turned it into like a Brazilian tune. And I used like, you know, the riff for Thunderstruck, and I reharmonized it middle. And I tried really hard, but as soon as the voice started singing, it just became funny. And it, So it wasn't so much that it's not a great song. It's a great riff, and the words are kind of, you know, party time words, right? Mm-hmm. But it just didn't, it just made, it made a mockery of the song, and it made a mockery of the orchestra. Like, it just, it, somehow, it didn't, if you hear an orchestra playing My Sharona, you kind of just think it's, you kind of laugh. Did you hear the London Symphony playing My Sharona? You know, it's kind of, it's that it doesn't, the song doesn't come off as being great, and the arrangement just sounds like, I don't know. So that was the one that I spent a lot of time on it too. So I was kind of bummed out about it, to be honest. Thanks for bringing it up.
Just to complicate things further, one microphone, many microphones?
Many. Yeah, many. A ribbon, a couple ribbon microphones. Royer and a cheap Canadian one that was great too. And then there was I did ear trumpet, was great on the bass and beautiful on the mandocello. And then a Peluso mic, that was great. And then Audio Technica 4050 SM7 was really great. I think that's it. That's all I use. Yeah.
Okay. When you're in the throes of these mandolin projects, do you even touch the guitar, or would that just mess up your brain?
Sometimes I didn't need to do it because the mandocello or the mandola or the mandolin, once you state the harmonic possibilities of it, then you can extend from there. And that's part of the arrangement. So if you're playing a line, then when you grab like an octave mandolin and you start playing harmony to it, you're already kind of extending the harmony. So I didn't play any guitar on it. And there was some temptation to play I'd play some dobro on it. And then I ended up just playing slide on the mandocello. I remember thinking it'd be really nice if I had something that was just kind of glistening, you know. And it was a low anthem song, God Save the Songbird. And that one, I really heard like a resonator on it, really. It's right, like I was telling you, my room is so small that it's probably right, literally right at my foot, my dobro, my resonator. But I thought, I'll just play. So that was probably as close as I got to that was, but then I just played slide on the mandocello, which sounds wicked.
Yeah. I mean, you're an incredible electric mandolin player, but you've self-imposed these rules that you want to keep it like it's, I guess, a 1910 or 1920s recording, but new songs, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, like when I started this, before even the first, I made a record called Maybell, and Maybell was a record that I made in 98. And that was it was eight mandolins, and it was be all me. Okay. But then when I really got into the orchestra stuff, it was a record called Field Recording. And the only way I could really do it was I had to make this fictional thing. So I made this orchestra called the Upper York Mandolin Orchestra, and I was on the road with Hugh Laurie, and I would go to my room and I would come up with names, like just fictitious names. And I made a website for the Upper York Mandolin Orchestra. And I put made up names of people that had been in the orchestra. This is before I even recorded a note. So I had to come up with this idea of what if I created an orchestra that's fictitious, and it would force me into not only making this record, but it would give a presence to the orchestra, but also I would arrange it differently than if it was just me arranging it. So I created a character, a guy by the name of Thomas Dooley, I called him. And he was a guy that was insane. He was a, he was, you know, just arranged and arranged and arranged and arranged, and everything was overarranged. So then when I started doing field recording, I everybody had a name, like the mandolin player had a name. It was all me. But I just created this world that was a mandolin orchestra. And I really was studying that music. Like I did a lot of research to see where are these orchestras? Like who are they? And there were a lot of symphony people who play, you know, and they have a good time. They have mandolins, mandola, mancello, and they play classics, you know? But I got really, really seriously into creating this world that was, even though it's recorded now, I really wanted to harken back to that era of the turn of the century, you know, like, you know, and so that I got really into that. And so once I got that bug, there was no turning back when it came to anything mandolin for me that was, you know, like an orchestra.
Wow. I mean, this is like method acting, method musician. And then you did it with the Johnny Goldtooth record too, right?
Yeah, it's sometimes easier being somebody else than yourself. You know, it's, at least it's more exciting. You know, you wake up with yourself all the time. Johnny was an idea too. Like I just thought it'd be fantastic to be somebody else, and it was a hoot, because I also toured as Johnny, where I actually had to be that character. So I'd wake up in the morning and put on makeup, and I'd have fake tattoos on my neck, on my face, on my hands, and black nail polish and the whole wardrobe I bought. And then I coerced the Sisters Euclid, which is a band I have, and they all became characters. It was not the most comfortable thing at times, because I decided that Johnny would always walk around. Like if I played a festival, he would not put his guitar in a case. So he'd be the guy, you know, when you see people on the street with a guitar, that was what I do. So I have a beautiful guitar, and I had the guitar made for Johnny, and it was a Jazz Bastard. It's a Billy Rowe guitar. It's a gorgeous guitar. And I went to Canadian Tire, which I guess in America would be Walmart. I don't know that Walmart. Yeah. Yeah, and I got the worst letters, JG, you know, that you put on the mailbox, mm-hmm. They stick. I stuck it right on the pick guard. And it was so gaudy. And I'd walk around dressed up like this guy. And I had to have glasses on, and people I would know, I would let on like I didn't know them, which was really hard to do and rude. And I got into the character, and it just really made it fun, like really a lot of fun doing it. So the I Love You project I felt like I was kind of being a little bit more honest with it, in that I did it for me. I wasn't a character. It was me. It was my record. I wasn't going to say Upper York Mandolin Orchestra, you know? So I came clean.
You came clean. But,
yeah.
I think everybody who's heard this interview and my Daniel Romano interview are going to wonder what's going on in the water up there. But you guys are all brilliant, so keep at it.
Thank you. You're very kind. You're a very kind man.
Since I didn't interview you when it came out, let's talk about the Stella Bella Estrada record. What was the thought behind that record?
I wanted to make a big band slide record that was like a string quartet. I thought would be great with a guitar that you would not think would fit, which is a distorted slide guitar. And I thought, what if you had horns? What would that sound like? So that's where I started, just as a concept, was that I would do that. And then at the same time, I'd asked Joe Iannuzzello if he would be interested in making this guitar. And I would write, it'd come out at the same time. So when Joe built the guitar, I'd be able to make the record at the same time. So I was preparing the record while the guitar was being made. And then, and it was a lot of musicians on that record, which was a lot of fun to do. Mm-hmm. And it was, it was kind of a really kind of a cool idea. At least ahead it was. I don't know if it came off that way, but the idea that it was just a record that's guitar that you wouldn't hear it in that context, which was not very clean, but really dirty guitar. But there's behind it are instruments that were supporting it that were very clean. And I don't know, that was the whole idea right there. It came from the concept of the sound of it. And then I just tried really, really hard not to ever change the sound of the guitar. Like, I wanted the sound, if you heard one song, you heard all the songs. Like, I really wanted to make it sound like it came from the same day, you know?
Sure.
Which is really hard to do, you know, because you go, I don't know if that fits with a, you know, a string quartet. Should I have it so guitar so loud, or should I clean it up, make it sound like, you know, Lowell George? Should it be really compressed and really glassy? And but then I think I did the right thing with that, because it seems to be, as you know, like I said, having recorded that record too, it seems like it's one thought, and that's what I was kind of going for, which I'm happy about.
When you asked Joe to build this guitar, did you, the voicing of a guitar, electric guitar, is such a complex thing. Did you already know what pickups you were going to use, or was there some trial and error there?
No, I did. It was, I wanted the guitar to look cool. So I actually typed in, cool looking pickups.
Okay.
and then you get funny and cool looking guitar pickups. Cause if you wrote cool pickups, you get something else on the internet.
Yeah.
So cool looking guitar pickups. So and I got some stuff, but then I thought, okay, I want the guitar to look like a machine, like an engine, like a beautiful Italian piece of machinery. So I typed in car parts, guitar. I can't remember how I got it, but then the company that came up was Mojo UK, and they had these pickups that just looked so good. And I thought, if it sounds as good as it looks. And then, of course, somebody had, I think it was probably from Mojo UK, they had hired a great guitar player. Like, it's great when a product is, you know, when it's being advertised, the person that's playing is really good and the guitar is in tune. And the guy had the exact pickups that we put in the Stella Bella in a Jazzmaster, and he was playing directly into his computer, and the guitar sounded so good. And then I was sold, because it sounds funny, but it looked really good. And then it sounded great.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the order really, but you of course you want it to sound good. But this did both. And that's, so I asked Joe about that, because he hadn't heard of Mojo UK. And subsequently, Joe, I think he's built a few of these guitars now. They call them Milanos. And he's built them with all, I believe they all have those pickups in them. And I don't know if you saw a picture of it, Jason, of the guitar, but the best thing about that guitar is in the pickups, in the front pickup, it's a picture of Marcello Mastroianni, and in the bridge, it's Sophia Loren. So they're actually looking out at the pickup. It's fantastic.
You're going to have to send me a picture of this to share.
Oh, yeah, it's on the cover, but I'll send you a picture of it because it's really fantastic. It's the sexiest beast ever. And it's like anything this guy builds, anything that Joe builds, it's a masterpiece. And this guitar is a masterpiece. It's just really great. I play so aggressively that I feel bad because it's so, like, it's so beautiful. And I've scratched it. I saw a scratch on it the other day. I don't know how I did it. And there's a ding in the neck, like, which is a, you know, so anybody else with the way the guitar looks would buff it up because it's so gorgeous. And it's, you know, metal flake, black metal flake, and it lights up. You know?
I did see that.
Lights up.
Was it your idea to do the Fellini homage or his?
Well, I wouldn't take credit for anything of beauty. I think that that guitar is the way it looks is him. That's him. That's Joe. I had suggestions of it looking like a machine and having lights on it. I wanted that.
Okay.
And that was his idea to put Sophia Loren and Marcello Mastroianni in there, mm-hmm. which is absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, there is the making of the damn thing, which is, and I wish I had filmed it. Like, I wish I had gone to his cheese factory, you know, like this guy's in the country. He bought a cheese factory and it's an old cheese factory. So now they don't make cheese there. He just makes great guitars. And I've known Joe for a long time, and I was going out a lot to see the progress of the Stella Bella. And it was just, and the whole time I didn't take one damn picture of it. And I wish I had, because that would have been a great accompaniment to the record if I had actually had the making of the damn guitar. But it's in my head. Maybe that's more important.
What slide were you using on that record?
It's just a Dunlop steel slide that I got when I was, I've had it since I was 12 or 13. And I don't even know if it was Dunlop then. I don't know if it was something else, but it was, I still have that guitar, that slide, but anything that you can get on at a store, I decided I would get that. So I was on the road and I lost a slide. I would just buy whatever was generic. So it's just a chrome slide.
Wow. And what, yeah. What amplifier or amplifiers?
That was a Demeter Mighty Mini. It's a Mighty Mini. It's a little head and I put it through a 1 10-inch speaker. I've called, do you know Henry Kaiser? You must know Henry.
Of course,
Henry.
Yeah. He's been here.
Well, Henry. Yeah, I wrote Henry and I said, Henry, I'm thinking of buying an amp for Cassandra Wilson. I'm going on the road and I'm going to get a different amp every night. Every night I'm going to get a different amp. And if I had a head and I'll just use whatever amplifier they give me, I'll just use their speakers from that amplifier. But I need a really great head. And he said, you got to get this. He said, let me show you. I'm going to take a picture of my studio, and this will tell you everything. So he sends me a picture, and he has two Dumble heads. Of course he has that.
Of course.
Two Howard Dumble heads, right. And on top of it is this little Mighty Mini by Demeter. And that's the only amp that's plugged in. And he said it reminded him so much of his Dumbles. He said he loves it. And it weighs 7 pounds. So I got it, and I used it on the road, and it blew my mind how good. So then I used that on the whole Johnny record, and I used it on the Stella Bella record.
Wow.
It has that great sound. There's something mighty about it. And it fits in a camera bag.
Got
it. And it's 140 watts.
You've had a busy lead up to I Love You, which came out a few weeks ago. I was just geeking out on the new David Gillis record, and you're on that too. Have you been pretty busy this year in terms of studio projects?
Yeah. Well, it's like we were talking earlier, we're all in the same lifeboat right now. So there's a lot of people making records, which is fantastic. A lot of my friends are, and they're doing it for therapy and for keeping themselves up and, you know, buoyed. I like all my water metaphors. Eh? It works good. Buoyed, lifeboats. So I've been busy. Like I've been busy playing on stuff and, you know, playing something new, like, you know, just planning stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of things being made. Everybody's making things, you know. I think it's been such a long haul, this pandemic, that I think I think a lot of people that have gone away and were, you know, somewhat not in good shape are now kind of back to wanting to work and wanting to make things. So I find that the phone's been ringing. It's been nice. It's been nice to create in this time of shit, you know.
Yeah. And do you already know what the next Kevin Bright big project is?
Well, I have a new record coming out with, it's called The Bonafide Scoundrels, and it's a quartet, and it was done just before we recorded, just before the pandemic, and it's all ready to come out. It's been mixed and mastered, and the artwork's been done. So that's gonna. It's just a quartet of fun, really fun music. But as far as my solo stuff, I don't know. Every day I think this is a great idea, and then I think, what a dumb idea. That is the dumbest idea. So I started writing, oddly enough, I started writing last night. I just pulled out a notepad and forced myself to start writing something. So we'll see, you know, but there'll be something, I'm sure. Somewhere down the line, there'll be something.
Sure.
I hope.
No one's playing anywhere right now, but when you did these mandolin records in the past, were you able to play them live?
Yes, I have. We promoted this record called Ernesto Delilah, and it was, I played mandocello, an octave mandolin, and had two mandolin players and a mandola player and a tuba player. And we just did all the bottom end. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. So yeah, it was definitely doable, and it was big. It was kind of funny how I thought, well, I amalgamated a lot of the parts into like one part. So if there was like four mandolin parts, I just get down to the best of the part and say, well, those parts we can do without, but maybe if you play this part. So it was great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So it was definitely doable. Yeah. And I loved it too, because nothing was plugged in. There was no monitors on the stage. So everybody had a microphone, and it was just, it was really great doing it. A great discipline. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I'm totally blown away. You've given me a lot of food for thought. I'm going to have to re-listen to these records now, knowing what I know. The I Love You record is amazing.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah.
It's a lot to ask. You know, when I send the record away, I'm so thankful anybody's heard it, because it is a bit of a telethon. There's a lot on that record. So, but thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Thank you so much, Kevin. This was amazing.
Oh, Jason, you take care. Have a great one.